Today's Teisho will be on Case 15 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan. Case 15 is entitled Tozan's 60 Blows. Tozan came to study with Umon. Umon asked, "Where are you from?" "From Sato," Tozan replied. "Where were you during the summer?" "Well, I was at the monastery of Hozu, south of the lake." "When did you leave there?" Umon asked. "On August 25. was Tozan's reply. "I spare you 60 blows," Umon said. The next day, Tozan came to Umon and said, "Yesterday you said you spared me 60 blows. I beg to ask you, where was I at fault?" "Oh, you rice bag," shouted Umon. "What makes you wander about, now west of the river, now south of the lake?" Tozan thereupon came to a mighty enlightenment experience. Umon's comment: if Umon had given Tozan the true food of Zen and encouraged him to develop an active spirit, his school would not have declined as it did. Tozan had an agonizing struggle through the whole night, lost in a sea of right and wrong. He reached a complete impasse. After waiting for the dawn, he went to Umon, and Umon again made him a picture book of Zen. Even though he was directly enlightened, Tozan could not be called brilliant. Now I want to ask you, should Tozan have been given 60 blows or not? If you say yes, you admit that all the universe should be beaten. If you say no, you accuse Umon of telling a lie. If you really understand the secret, you will be able to breathe out Zen spirit with the very mouth of Tozan. Umon's verse: the lion had a secret to puzzle his cub. The cub crouched, leaped, and dashed forward. The second time, a casual move led to a checkmate. The first arrow was light. The second went deep. So I want to thank you for braving the traffic. I guess we usually don't have a Saturday sit on this Saturday, and we won't ever do it again. My understanding is that the traffic is very heavy outside, and I hope other people didn't become discouraged and drive away. Usually we would have our Saturday sit a week from today. But because of the change in our schedule, we haven't had it this week. I made a mistake. I do feel sorry for somebody who got in his car this morning and maybe looked at the sky and thought, "Oh boy, you know, there could be a hurricane coming up, but I'm still going to go to Zen." And that person got in the car early in the morning and drove all the way to New Brunswick, only to find that it was bumper-to-bumper traffic. And I can easily see that a person like that would fall into various mental states. So, I mean, one mental state might be like this. You might say, "Oh man, wouldn't you know it, I really needed to sit today. I really needed to meditate today. And now look, traffic. You know, this is just my luck. I can't win." Right? Can you see somebody having that response? I can. I can easily imagine somebody getting up and thinking, "I really need a good sit today," and driving all the way here, and maybe driving for an hour, and getting here and then being unable, and as you sit in line, you feel more and more helpless and more like the universe is against you. So to that person I owe an apology. I'm so sorry. I'm afraid that I'm responsible. Now, there's another kind of person who would have gotten up today, and maybe they live an hour away, and And they drive all the way here, and there's this big line. And they could become mad as hell. Really mad. You know, we canceled the last Saturday sit and moved it to today because I was away. And apparently 5 people came expecting to sit. So maybe one of these people is one of the 5 people who came last time. And basically, this person might have come last time and thought, okay, anyone can make a mistake. Okay, so this time he's coming, but what do you know? It's bumper-to-bumper traffic. And I can see somebody just becoming furious, right? Just furious. Those idiots, you know, that Zen group, those people are idiots. Idiots. You know? Those idiots, you know. I came all this fucking way and nothing, I've got nothing to show for it, right? I could see, I mean, can you imagine that happening? I can. There's another person, I can imagine somebody coming to driving here and not being able to get in and feeling very deprived. Like, you know, like imagining, thinking, oh man, you know, I wish I were in that zendo right now. And feeling very deprived because, you know, we're all in here doing zazen, practicing the way, and that person could feel also, I mean, one of the things that is nice about our sangha is like the spirit of community, seeing other people. And this person could be lonely and could feel very deprived, you know. And so this person could be sitting in his car or her car feeling very lonely, like all alone in the world, or rejected, like abandoned, you know, like abandoned. You know, and these are various styles of response to events, you know. The feeling of abandonment is something we probably all know, you know. I'm a teacher, I'm a classroom teacher, and I have a fear of abandonment myself. My worst nightmare is that I'll be walking into my class and no one will be there. And that has actually happened to me because of like snow or something like that, you know. And you walk into the room and nobody's there. Right, and this is actually rather terrifying because, you know, if you define yourself as a teacher and you have no students, then what are you? So it's frightening in a way. So this fear of abandonment is very real, and it's a deep human fear. And also this feeling of anger, you know, in the face of an obstacle, or this feeling of, you know, there are people who would probably never come back to our Zen group after having been thwarted like that. You know, they would, I'm not coming back there, you know, to those idiots. You know. And then there are people who would feel guilty. I forgot about those people, but they would feel like, oh, if only I had gotten up early, you know, they're coming for 9:30, they think, oh my God, if only I had come at 7, you know, why did I do this to myself? And then they feel guilty. These are all different styles of responding to events, and they're very recognizably human, aren't they? There's even a kind of style where somebody gets here and congratulates oneself for doing it. It's like, I got in, you know? And that's another style, like it's a competitive mind, you know, like I got in. You know, those other guys didn't get in, but I got in. That's very American, I would say. You know, I got in. I got up early. I got here. I beat the traffic, and I'm in. Right? Very, very modern mind. All of these are responses to events, and they all have their origins in a kind of small self thinking. They're very recognizable human responses. We're going somewhere. We want to get to our goal. It's very important. You know, I myself have, you know, I get up very early to sit, and I got up, you know, actually reasonably early today to come here to sit. And it's important, you know, if I were supposed to open the Zendo today and I couldn't get here, I would have anxiety. I mean, I would be like, if I were trying to get here and open up and set up and everything, and maybe a train accident or something blocked my way and I couldn't get here, I'd be very anxious, you know, because I'd feel personally responsible for the sit this morning. And I might sit in my car, very anxious, trying to call people on my phone, feeling guilty, feeling incompetent, and so on. You know, this is basically a human response to being derailed or being blocked or having things not go our way. There is really no way to control some of these events, you know. I mean, the traffic outside is probably much worse today because of the oncoming storm. You know, maybe normally this would not be such a difficult situation. You know, a combination of events made it really very, probably very difficult for anybody to get here. No one really probably could have foreseen completely what was going to happen, no matter how good a planner they were. Really surprised by how poor humans are at predicting the future. I was reading something the other day. I just got back and I was reading some newspapers. And I was reading about the economy. And it was interesting. I read one person who said that there's no chance that we're going back into recession because the fundamentals are so strong. And they looked at manufacturing and so on and so on. Then I read another person who said, we're very likely to go into a recession. And then another person said it was a 50-50. So it was like the whole spectrum. And then I read my favorite, Paul Krugman, who says we're already in a recession. So really it occurred to me that these people are really highly trained and they really are very smart, but none of them really can foresee what's going to happen. There's a huge element of chance. And when there's a huge element of chance, it really forces us to recognize our limitations as at the limitations of our control over ourselves and over the world. And this is really frightening. It's really frightening in a way. You know, it gets under our skin. You know, with something like the economy, the events are so huge and important that that we can all see that it's of consequence. But even something like trying to get to an appointment and being thwarted is very frightening or very disconcerting because we realize how little control we have over things. We try so hard to control our lives, and so much apparently depends on our self-discipline and alertness. But sometimes life just throws us something that we can't have foreseen, you know. And then we realize that we're in a tough spot, you know. We're sort of like not as, we don't have as much control as we think. And I think those are the moments when we get angry or reproach ourselves or feel guilty. Those are all strategy, the response to what's uncontrollable. You know. Every once in a while, it happens though that we get beyond that kind of a feeling of entrapment or disempowerment. You know. When I was much younger, I finished my first 4 years of college, and I wanted to travel, but actually the year I finished college, 1975, was actually a bad year for the economy. And the economy actually got worse as the 70s went on. We had something called stagflation. Employment picture was not very good for college graduates. And anyway, I didn't have a lot of money, but I wanted to see the world. So my friend Larry Sullivan and I decided to hitchhike across the United States like Jack Kerouac. And hitchhiking is really a very good Zen training. I wouldn't recommend it if you're a woman. I definitely wouldn't hitchhike. And maybe now it's not safe for anybody. But back in the 70s, it was really quite safe to hitchhike, and it was even popular. In California, when I was hitchhiking in California, the ramps were just loaded with hitchhikers, and they were all these young hippie types in their ponchos and strange hats all lined up waiting for a ride. But I did a lot of hitchhiking, and I hitchhiked all the way from Northern Virginia across to Seattle, and also from there down to New Mexico. And I was actually like a disciplined hitchhiker. So I would stay in my tent, actually. I had a tent and I had my backpack. And when Larry and I would hitchhike together, we would stay in one tent and leave the other one folded up. And, you know, we had an alarm clock and it would ring and we'd get up before, just as the sun was coming up, and we'd pack up the tent, and if we were staying in a campsite or something, we'd wash our faces and brush our teeth, and then we'd get out on the road. And you want to get out early, and we would stick out our thumbs and hopefully catch a ride. But you know, it's an absolutely uncontrollable situation. You know, you can get up really early in the morning to hitchhike, but that doesn't mean you'll get any rides, and it doesn't mean you'll get good rides. You know, so a good ride is if you're in Northern Virginia, you get a ride to like Ohio or something like that. That's like a hitchhiker's dream come true. A bad ride would be a ride 50 miles down the road, because you're going to get in somebody's car, ride an hour, and then you'll be dumped in the middle of nowhere. So you know, you're hoping for a really good ride, and you're out there on the road, and you've got your backpack neatly in front of you and your thumbs out, and you have a big smile on your face to show that you're not a serial killer. You know. And then somebody picks you up, and it's a real adventure, you know. Because it might be a good ride. It might be 100, you know, it might be 500 miles, you know. And you get in the car, and I've met such interesting people hitchhiking. Because you get in the car, and people often pick you up because they have a long drive and they want companionship. They want somebody to keep them, among other things, awake behind the wheel. And you know, so you are supposed to engage with them in conversation. And you know, sometimes you really hit it off. I've hitchhiked with people who let me stay in their homes. You know, this was the 70s, so you know, it was very routine for somebody to say, "Do you want to smoke a joint?" You know, we'd smoke a joint in the car, and hey, they'd take me to lunch. You know, often after the joint, "Do you want some lunch?" So, you know, this was all wonderful. It was like a magic world. You stick out your thumb, some interesting person picks you up. You know, he's got, you know, he envies you because you're footloose and fancy free, and it takes you somewhere, and it's a wonderful thing, you know. But you know, the thing is, you can't count on it. And there are mornings where you get out there early and hours go by and nothing happens. Nobody picks you up. And you wait maybe half a day, even into the afternoon, and finally you catch a ride, and it might be take you 500 miles, or it might take you 100 miles. You know, sometimes when I was hitchhiking across the country, I would get in places that were absolutely magnificent. There's a place where you turn off of Route 80 in Montana and you head south to New Mexico. I can't remember the name of the highway that goes south. But it's the most glorious intersection in America. Because you can look up at the Teton Mountains and you can see the Livingston Valley and you can see Yellowstone. It's glorious. But, you know, I've been dropped off there and I've sat there for like 6 hours. You know, and you know, it's almost like meditation, right? You're stuck by the road, and you're waiting for a ride, and the ride. You know, sometimes the cars just don't even come by. There aren't even any cars, you know. And you look, you know, maybe hear birds. Sometimes there's a magpie on a fence post, you know, or a horse nearby, or something, or. You see a little fox running by. You know, it's amazing what you can see. But mostly you're just sitting there. And sometimes you can have a book. You can sit on your backpack and read a book. But you need to be alert because you don't want to be reading your book while the one ride that hour goes by. For a certain kind of personality type, hitchhiking would be truly torture. But I think it was an early training in Zazen because, you know, you get out on the road with these hopes of catching a ride. And, you know, at first you think, I'm going to get a ride. I just know it. I feel lucky today. But you don't get a ride. And then, you know, basically the day goes on and you could get mad. You could say, God damn it. You know, why am I doing this? This is so stupid. Why didn't I just take the bus? Or you could say, ah, I should have gotten up earlier. Or why did I choose this route? You know, and you could lacerate yourself. You could get mad at, you know, the United States. You could say, these Americans are selfish bastards. You know, they never give anybody a ride, you know. A whole range of things. But, you know, it can be strangely wonderful to be open to what's happening. You know, to be open to what's happening. And it's like a discipline. It's like a training, you know, I think, to wait by the side of the road for a ride because you can't control it. You just have to be open to the possibility. And this is so much like Zen. It's so much like life, right? I mean, somebody could have come here today, could have gotten up, driven all this way, gotten into traffic and thought, damn it. You know? But there's no particular reason to be unhappy, really. You know, there's a way of being present with the moment, whatever it is. And if we can just be fully present with the moment as it is, it becomes really a wonderful place to be. And this is sort of like the lesson of Zen and the lesson of hitchhiking. You know, we imagine a certain situation as being unbearable, insulting, unendurable, cruel, etc., etc., you know. A waste of time, a waste of my precious time. You know. But on the other hand, you know, if we just give up that desire to have a certain outcome, we can begin to investigate the moment that's in front of us, the moment that's in front of us. Now, you know, Zen makes you a promise. You know, if you say, what is Zen all about? Zen is all about that moment is enlightenment. That moment is enlightenment. So, you know, it would be incorrect to say that in order to have enlightenment, you need to be in a particular state, seated on a mat with a straight spine, counting the breath, focused on the breath. If you think that's the road to enlightenment, you haven't understood Zen. All of those methods are just upaya, skillful means. And the real method is to be fully with the moment as it unfolds. And this is difficult for us, you know. So we prepare ourselves. We practice. We come in and we sit on the cushion. We enter samadhi and so on and so on. But ultimately, Zen is about being one with the unfolding of the universe. And so it's possible to drive here for an hour and be very happy if you don't get to sit. In fact, somebody told me that he came last week. He was here last night. A guy came last night and he said, I came last Saturday and there was no sit. And he said, the strangest thing happened. I drove all the way here for the sit and there was no sit. But he said, when I drove home, I still felt much better. I swear he said that. I swear on a stack of sutras. He said, I felt much better, like I'd meditated. And that hit me like a ton of bricks, right? Because I thought, my God, it worked, you know? I mean, we come here to meditate, but what we really are here to do is to be fully with the moment, right, as it unfolds. And he was. And he could have gotten mad. He could have gotten upset. And sometimes we just don't want this moment, you know. But Zen says, if you're just with the moment, 100%, that is enlightenment. See, that's Zen. So if you're, you know, as soon as you say this isn't the moment I want, you create huge obstacles. And we all do it all the time. We have karma, you know. We have fears, right? We have fears, you know. So if we're driving here and we're trying to get to the sit, and we're blocked, you know. There's a whole hit. We bring a whole history to that, right? You know, maybe when we were a kid, we wanted to do something and we couldn't ever do it. And so we're back in that state of mind. Or maybe you didn't get into medical school and, you know, basically you felt it took you years to get over that. Now here you are in traffic and you're reliving that feeling of being trapped or blocked. Or maybe, you know, your parents neglected you and you're sitting in the car and you're feeling so alone. You know, so alone. I wanted to be in the Zendo with the Sangha. I'm so alone. And by the way, I'm not belittling any of these. These are all really human responses. You know, I have them too, you know. So I'm not making fun of them. I'm just saying that what we need to do is realize that in this moment, as it's unfolding, enlightenment is present. Buddha mind is present. And so what we have to kind of do is surrender to the moment, let it go and see where it's going, you know, and be one with the moment. This doesn't mean responding passively. This is not about passivity. Not at all. When we're in the state of mind where we're feeling angry or injured or paralyzed, then it's very difficult for us to respond, to be one with the moment, you know, and one with the moment. Then we're sort of frozen. This is a big problem. People get frozen or arrested. You know, in Zen, you have all these stories of teachers and students encountering each other in these crazy exchanges. And this is one of them, right? Tozan came to study with Umon. Umon asked, "Where are you from?" Now, that's a kind of a Zen question, right? He's saying, "Where are you from?" And Tozan says, "From Sato." He said, "Well, where were you during the summer?" Now, these are all Zen questions, right? They're not just about, you know, where. If a Zen master says to you, "Where you're from," it doesn't necessarily mean that he wants you to say Washington, D.C. or something like that. It's saying, what is the source of your awareness, right? So Umon says, "Where are you from?" That's a Zen question, right? And Tozan takes it literally. He says, "From Sato." And, where were you during the summer? "Well, I was at the monastery of Hozu, south of the lake." "When did you leave?" Umon asked. "August 25, was Tozan's reply. And Umon said, "I spare you 60 blows." See, now, this is like, Tozan is going to see Umon. And it's their first encounter. And Umon's a very famous Zen master, and Tozan is a student who wants to wake up. So he goes to see Umon, and Umon is actually asking him a lot of Zen questions. He's trying to see what the depth of Tozan's mind is. So he says, "Where are you from?" Now, Tozan could have said, you know, "Actually, at this moment, my mind is blank, you know, or something like that." But he just says, "I'm from, where are you from?" "From Sato." And Tozan replied. And then Umon says, "Where were you during the summer?" This is like a Zen question, you know. In other words, you know, show me the self that is present, always present, summer, winter, spring, and fall. But Tozan says, "Well, I was at the monastery of Hozu, south of the lake," and so on. He gives very, you could say, small mind answers. And Umon says at the end of the interview, "I spare you 60 blows," which is such an interesting response, because he's saying to him, "Your answers were no good, and they deserve 60 blows, but I'm not going to hit you with 60 blows." This is such a great answer, see, because, first of all, he makes Tozan feel like his answers were no good. But not only does he do that, but he says, "I'm not even going to hit you. You deserve 60 blows, but I'm not going to give them to you." And that's something else for Tozan to worry about. So Tozan can leave that interview and he can say, "Oh my God, I gave bad answers to the Roshi." And he could be worried about that, but not only is he going to worry about that, he's also going to say, "Oh my God, why didn't he? He should have given me 60 blows. He must have complete contempt for me." See? So he's thinking, if only he had given me 60 blows, I'd feel so much better about myself. Then I would have given a wrong answer, but I know he respects me. Now, I gave the wrong answer, and he didn't even give me 60 blows. He spared me, meaning I'm never going to amount to anything as a Zen student. See? So this is so human, right? That's so human. So now he's second-guessing himself. He's trying to imagine better answers, you know, and so on and so on. So the next day, Tozan came to Umon and said, "Yesterday you spared me 60 blows. I beg to ask you, where was I at fault?" This is like the normal small mind, right? It's not 100% with the moment, right? It's It's second guessing. It's worried about the outcome. It's imagining itself in the wrong. In the wrong. Yeah. This is so important. We go around all our lives imagining ourselves in the wrong. You know? It's amazing how often we feel in the wrong. Like there's something fundamentally defective about us. There's something fundamentally incorrect about us, right? I mean, I think this is deeply felt, maybe by all humans, but it's not an awakened mind, right? It's not awakened mind. That feeling of like being profoundly defective or profoundly inadequate. And people go around their whole lives feeling this way, feeling at fault or guilty. What did I say? If only I'd said something different. You know, this sort of self-reproach so common. And it produces a kind of frozen mind. A few weeks ago, after a Saturday sit, I walked up to somebody and I said, how was your sit? And the person said, oh, it was okay. But okay. And I said, I laughed and I said, you know, if you sat more, your sit would be better. Now, I think this person was mad at me. Right? Because actually, what I said was kind of like bullshit. This person is one of my best students. He comes to every sesshin. He practices diligently. What he should have done right then was maybe he should have slapped my face. Or maybe he should have said, what a load of crap. I've been to every sesshin, right? I would say maybe at that moment, you know, the person's mind was frozen by this feeling of being in the wrong. And by the way, part of Zen practice is learning is not being trapped like that. Not being trapped is learning how to be spontaneous. You know, we're not spontaneous because we don't trust ourselves, and that's because we don't trust the moment. We think, oh, I should be in some other moment. This isn't the right moment. You know, I mean, wouldn't it be great? I mean, wouldn't it be great if, have you ever seen this? You know, this happens maybe only in movies. But I have been in places where the traffic has jammed up and it's hopelessly jammed and there's just like a long line on the highway and people get out of their cars and talk to each other. You know, have you ever, it's wonderful, you know. You realize I'm not going to get there and what's going on? You can walk up and down, you know. I mean, in an ideal world, you know, in a situation like that, people would say, you know, would you like a Coke? You know, would you like, you know, you'd walk around and chat with people, share food, you know. Maybe you decided to come to the Zen Center today, and you're driving here, and there's a line, and the line is just sitting there. And then all of a sudden, let's say some couple get out of their car, and they start dancing. Wouldn't that be wonderful? That would just be great, you know. You know, maybe the tango or something like that, you know. That might be too much to ask. Of the universe. But it would be perfect, right? It would be like, crap, I can do that? You know, I can do that? Wow, I could be happy right now. You mean I could be happy right now? I don't have to be miserable, you know? You get out of your car, you know, you could turn on the radio, listen to it. Radio. You could get out, you know, and stretch your legs, look around. You know, if it's raining, you know, rain is actually beautiful. You could go talk to somebody. The moment could be really wonderful, you know, and we could be very creative. You know, it could be very creative with this moment. We don't have to be trapped by the moment, you know. And so, you know, Zen practice is about learning how to be present in the moment without judgment. And then there's another dimension to Zen practice, which is this more dynamic aspect, which is sort of responding creatively to the moment, you know, which isn't, and that's very difficult to do unless we have no goals, you know, unless we have no goals. It's, you know, when you're so point A to point B, when your mind's like that, it's very difficult to look around and suddenly realize, you know, I can remember standing on the highway sometime and just thinking, thank God I'm here, you know, stuck in this, you know, desert. It's so beautiful, right? You know, you hear a hawk going by or something like that, and it's just like, this is the perfect moment. You know, I have the feeling that when I die, I'm going to remember that some of those moments. You know, they're just so rich, you know, so beautiful. That sort of, you know, it's like suddenly you can breathe and you can take in the air and you can see the world with this lively eye. Or suddenly you can act, you know. You can, okay, my goal was to go from here to here. I was going to go get in my car and drive to the sit this morning, but I got stuck. And if we say I'm in the wrong, as usual, I'm not where I should be, things are not going the way they should go, then we're destined to be unhappy, right? But not just that, but that's just not true, right? I mean, if we can be in the moment, suddenly wonderful things can happen. You know, you can turn it around if you're just able to be fully present in the moment. And, you know, if we trust the moment, you know, eventually, it's very hard, but we eventually develop a kind of trust in being with the moment, you know. In other words, you know, you read these stories you know, Joshu puts his shoe on his head and goes out the door, and you think, what is that all about? You know, it's like, that's a person who has like a profound, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but sometimes, you know, in my life, you know, I have felt really trapped or defeated, you know. And it's like, I have felt in my life sometimes really defeated. Like this is, you know, like this is the end of the world, you know. And then all of a sudden, you just snap out of it, you know, and you feel this energy arising. I bet you've had that experience, you know. Where you feel, you know, you just feel like, I'm totally trapped. You know, I'm totally defeated. And then all of a sudden there's this, you think, where the hell is this energy coming from? Why the hell am I happy right now? You know? And this is like the secret of Zen. You know? What disappears in a situation like that is all of this framework of expectations. And when it falls apart, all of a sudden, everything comes to life. You know, this actually happened to me on this hiking trip that I took. You know, I totally screwed up the sesshin, the October sesshin. I mean, the August sesshin, because I used Rutgers calendar, academic calendar, 2 years ago. And sesshin, school was not supposed to start this week. It was supposed to start next week. It was not supposed to start next week. It was supposed to start after Labor Day. That's the original Rutgers calendar. So I booked the sesshin for this week. But Rutgers then changed its calendar And I was stuck because I had to do my job, and I couldn't not go to my job and go to Sesshin. So I went to this hiking, I went on this hiking trip feeling a little bit guilty. And also, I had a problem. I have a chronic kind of arthritis called gout. And I had a gout attack in my knee about 2 weeks before I had to go hiking. And so my knee was still bothering me. My knee was still bothering me when I got to Idaho, where I was going to hike. And indeed, I was in a lot of pain on the hike, but I didn't want to not go on this hike, which I've been planning to do for a long time. And I didn't want to let my friends down. And unlike the second or third day of the hike, we reached our destination, and I had been like popping pills, you know, like, pain reliever pills for my knee. And my friend went off into the woods, into the mountains to explore, and I soaked my legs in this very cold mountain stream. And my knee was really hurting me. And I was feeling really sorry for myself, you know. And I was thinking, oh dear, you know, can I go on? What's going to happen? You know, this is such a bummer, you know. No Sesshin. Now this, blah, blah, blah. You know, now that I can't even hike, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And then all of a sudden, it was just like, honestly, I'm not... It was just like the world opened up, you know? And it was like I felt so connected to everything about me, around me. And I realized, my God, this is beautiful here, you know? So it was just like all my framework of expectations and familiar mental habits fell away, and it was just like the most beautiful kind of connectedness. You know, it was just like absolute trust. You know, absolute trust, intimacy. Right? It was just like absolute trust, and I felt so good. You know. And then all the pain in my knee went away. Not really. But I still had a wonderful time, right? And I, thanks to Excedrin, and I had a great hike. But that moment made the hike for me. After that, everything was easier because I had gotten into that place of trust. And that's what this koan is about. You know, Uman has undermined Tozan's trust. See, Tozan came in and met Uman, and he was just honest and open. You know, he didn't try to be Zen. He didn't say, "Where am I from?" "Nowhere." You know, that would have been a Zen answer. So he said, "I'm from Sato. I was at the lake, south of the lake. You know, in summer. You know, when did you leave? August 25th." So, but Uman undermines his trust. Uman says, you know, you didn't quite give the right answer. You know, I should have hit you. Not only did you not give the right answer, but you gave such a bad answer, I should have hit you with 60 blows, but I won't even do that. So the next day, Tozan came to Uman and said, "Yesterday you said you spared me 60 blows. What did I do wrong, man? Tell me, I'm in the wrong. How am I in the wrong?" And Uman says, "Oh, you rice bag. What makes you think you were in the wrong, basically? You know, there's no problem here," he says. "What makes you wander about, now west of the river, now south of the lake?" Tozan came to a mighty enlightenment experience. You know, I think it was a lot like what happened to me up there, you know. I was feeling that this is not right, and this is not right, and this is not right. And then I soaked my legs in this freezing cold water, and I started doing Zazen. And all of a sudden, it was just like everything fell away, and it was just this energy popped up, you know, this energy. I think Zen practice is really like that. You know, you go to Sesshin, and you by about day two, you're destroyed. You know, it's like, oh man, I'm totally defeated, you know. I'm totally wiped out. I can't take another step. And then all of a sudden this energy arises and everything is open and there's this intimacy or this sense of connectedness. Yeah? So this could happen to you. You know, driving here, you had your heart set on coming to sit and basically you got stopped in line and you didn't get to the sit today. There's a wonderful book that I would highly recommend called The Snow Leopard by Peter Mathiasen, who is a Buddhist priest, a Zen priest, and a great writer. And throughout the whole book, he goes up to the Himalayas, and he's trying to see a snow leopard with the great biologist George Schaller. And the whole book, they're trying to they find the traces of the snow leopard, and they're stalking it. And it's so important to find it because they're trying to save the species, which is in such danger. And they find footprints, and they find scat, they find the fecal remains, they find hairballs, but they never find the snow leopard. And at the end of the book, somebody said, well, did you ever find the snow leopard? And Mathiasen said, no. Isn't that wonderful? See, and what's really wonderful about it is what did happen. You know, once he got over not finding what he was looking for. So, you know, if you came to sit, this is a Taisho that I'm delivering to the wrong people because everybody's here. But for the people who aren't here, you know, if they somehow can sense what I'm saying, you know, it would be very on-Zen to get in the car and drive here and then be blocked and get mad, right? I mean, that's not Zen. What's happening is the unfolding of the universe, and we make ourselves one with it, you know. And usually that means being very frustrated and angry and suddenly letting go. And then it's just wonderful. And then we can act spontaneously and freely without doubt, without hesitation, right? Without feeling we're in the wrong place. Mumon's comment, if Umon had given Tozan the true food of Zen and encouraged him to develop an active Zen spirit, right? Being fully in the moment and not self-conscious. His school would not have declined as it did. Tozan had an agonizing struggle through the whole night, lost in the sea of right and wrong. He reached a complete impasse. After waiting for the dawn, he again went to Umon, and Umon made him a picture book of Zen. Even though he was directly enlightened, Tozan could not be called brilliant. Now, Mumon is trying to make you worried again about whether enlightenment is good enough, right? Now, I want to ask you, should Tozan have been given 60 blows or not? If you say yes, you admit that all the universe should be beaten. If you say no, you accuse Mumon of telling a lie. If you really understood the secret, you will be able to breathe out Zen spirit with the very mouth of Tozan. So that moment when we sort of give up, and the energy arises, or when we realize our plans are falling apart, and there's this wonderful energy. This is the Zen life. Yeah. Mumon's verse: the lion had a secret to puzzle his cub. The cub crouched, leaped, and dashed forward. The second time, a casual move led to the checkmate. The first arrow was light, but the second went deep.